WLNS-TV reports that the city of Jackson faces a $700,000 budget deficit. And reporter Shelby Miller writes, one closely considered option is to cut from the city's emergency response team. Jackson Police Chief Matthew Hines comments, it's difficult to provide services on the same level that we're used to providing for the community, unquote. The layoffs would leave Jackson with 45 police officers and 16 firefighters. And Ms. Miller writes, that's a big difference compared to the 40 firefighters, boy, from 40 to 16, that the city had just a few years ago. We'll keep an eye on it. You've got Current State here for Wednesday. We're glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. A recent report casts doubt on the impact of two decades of tax cutting here in Michigan. It suggests that the resulting cuts in public revenue have seriously prevented a greater prosperity. Michigan's tax policies, wrong turns on the path to prosperity, is a data-driven analysis that finds $51 billion in public revenue have been eliminated due to tax cuts. Among some noticeable conclusions, that most of the $51 billion reduction would have gone to K-12 education, that Michigan ranks 49th in the country in terms of the percentage of state and local taxes paid by business. The report, overseen by former state treasury official Douglas Drake, was underwritten by a consortium of teacher and education groups, including the Michigan Education Association, the Michigan Association of School Boards, and others. Mr. Drake is recovering from an illness, so to explore the study and its findings a little more, we welcome a colleague of his. Mitch Bean is founder and partner of Great Lakes Economic Partners in Eaton Rapids and is the former director of the House Fiscal Agency. Welcome, Mitch.
Thank you.
Did the general conclusion of the study here, that there's little reason to link tax cutting with prosperity, did that surprise you?
Oh, not at all. Neither did the magnitude of the tax cuts. I mean, $51 billion is a lot of money, and a $34 to $38 billion hit on schools, that's a lot of money. Of course, that's over a 20-year period.
Mm-hmm.
That's not each year. That's over a 20-year period. But when you look at, for example, the magnitude of the cuts, if you look at a publication that Treasury put out about the first 10 years of Proposal A, it's called Proposal A Retrospective. And it showed that the tax cuts to schools from Proposal A was $17 billion the first 10 years. So the idea that it's 34 to 38 over 20 years doesn't surprise me at all. Mm. And looking at, magnitude of the cuts that have taken place in general cuts, I mean, that's the biggest part of it. But, yeah, the $51 billion didn't surprise me at all.
One of the key points in the study is that there's little, if any, connection between tax cutting and increases in personal income. Page 18, quote, Michigan had the smallest, well, this is the smallest increase in the nation in taxes. It's not, doesn't refer to cutting necessarily, but the smallest increase in the nation in taxes as measured on a per capita basis from 1977 to 2011. Page 17, measured as a percentage of personal income over the same period, Michigan's increase was 42nd lowest in the nation. Can you help our non-economists understand why there's a disconnect there? Those two would seem to be related.
Well, what you really need to look at for prosperity, actually, which is what this is all about, you know, have we prospered with these tax cuts, is you look at per capita personal income. And we went, in 1994, we were ranked about 18th highest in, number one is the highest. We're ranked about 18th in the nation. 1994, it dropped down to about 35th. So, you know, our ranking is, you know, way below average. This stuff
despite tax cutting,
despite
people working, in theory at least, keeping more of their income?
Yeah. Here's the issue with state tax cuts. They're really different than federal tax cuts. The feds can cut taxes to stimulate the economy and keep on spending money because they can deficit spend.
Yeah.
We can't do that. We've got a balanced budget amendment, as all but one state does. And, so when we cut taxes, we reduce revenue and we have to reduce services. Now, services are really important to the economy. An advanced capitalist economy like ours, has to have things like an educated workforce, has to have infrastructure, has to have the right kind of regulatory environment, has to have public safety, has to have courts, has to have a social safety net. These are all things that are paid for with taxes. Now, they can be provided either directly by government, or government can contract with the private sector. You can do a private-public partnership. There's different ways to do it, but they're all paid for with taxes. And when you reduce revenue, you have to reduce services. Now, in my opinion, and I've held this opinion for some time now, we've reduced services so much that it's a detriment to the economy, and it overwhelms any potential stimulus from state tax cuts. But when you look at, if you just look at the magnitude of things, you know, Michigan's economy is about 2.5% of the national economy. That's all, you know, we don't run the national economy. The national economy runs us. That's the way it is.
2.5%.
2.5%, right. We're about a $350 billion economy.
Everybody's thinking of that old saw that they've heard that Michigan, if it were an independent nation, it would be the eighth richest nation in the world or something like that. Maybe that goes back to a previous, more prosperous decade.
Yeah, I never heard that, but, we are a big economy, but relative to the nation as a whole, which is over a trillion dollar economy, $350 billion, $14 trillion, that's a big difference. Now, and we're kind of overwhelmed by what the feds do. You know, when you got monetary policy, you've got federal fiscal policy, I say they can do some things. All we can do is set an environment where things can prosper. Now, part of that, though, is you got to have the right amount of revenue to actually produce the services you need. You got to have an educated workforce. Well, we've cut the heck out of education. Look at what's happened to higher education. You know, it's been cut about 25% in the last 10 years. Adjusted for inflation, it's over 30%.
Is it good that the state is obligated to balance its budget every year?
Oh, absolutely.
Or is that contributing? Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean,
if
we didn't have to balance our budget, though, we could theoretically enjoy services and not have to pay for them, at least right away.
Yeah, that's not – we don't want to do that.
So, okay, being obligated to balance our budget is a good idea.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And also, we don't have monetary policy. We don't print our own money like the feds do.
Right.
So, you know, that makes things a lot different as well.
Clarify one other point that I found really interesting here. In its coverage of the Drake report, MERS News wrote, and they're speaking of Doug Drake here when they write
sure.
this, quote, "He's not implying that the tax slashes caused the downward economic slope, but he said the decline makes it obvious that the policies have failed." Can you help us understand the point there?
Sure.
I mean, the thrust of the report would seem to suggest a connection.
Now, what Doug is saying, and within the report, he has some charts and so forth that show this, but the main reason that we went into such a deep recession is that our most prominent industry, the auto industry, went from about a 74% market share down to about a 40% market share, and the market itself shrunk from 16 million units a year on average to about 10.
Yeah.
You know, there's no industry that can take that kind of hit and not be in trouble. Now, if you were to look at reduction in people working in the auto industry, direct auto employment, your manufacturing and so forth, or rather your auto assembly plants, there was a huge reduction. I'm thinking, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm thinking it was from about 350,000 down to about 150,000. And each one of those jobs has this really important effect on other jobs and the suppliers. So one of those jobs affects, you know, 5-6 other jobs. In fact, if you look at that, just that alone, you know, we lost a cumulative of about 850,000 jobs during a 10-year recession that we were in. It's almost entirely explained by what happened in the auto sector. So it wasn't tax policy that did that. That was just, you know, the economics of the national economy and, you know, the decisions of buyers in the auto sector and so forth. That tax policy didn't have anything to do with that. But we've been told for 20 years that tax policy was going to take care of that. The tax policy would stimulate the economy. One of the things that was blamed on the previous administration. Well, you know, their policies drove us into a recession. Oh, that's nonsense.
Hmm.
You know, nobody could have withstood that.
Our special guest on Current State Today, former House Fiscal Agency Director Mitch Bean. And today, Mitch is a partner in Great Lakes Economic Partners in Eaton Rapids. Can a credible case be made? I mean, we're talking about a 20-year period here with this report. Can a credible case be made that Michigan's taxes could have been, quote, too high, unquote, 20 years ago, but that cutting has simply gone too far?
Well, if they were too high 20 years ago, the question has to be then, why were we in the upper tier in terms of per capita personal income? We were ranked 18th in 1994. Mm. And by the time, 20 years later, we were at about 34th. So the more we cut taxes, the more, the less prosperity we had. Mm. And in fact, if you were to look at any report, Doug looks at some of this. You look at states that are good states to actually compare our economy to because they're similar. It's not the low tax states that prosper. It's actually higher tax states that spend their money on the services that really make a difference. For example, we've cut over $6 billion since about 2000 out of money going to local governments. You just mentioned the issue down in Jackson. They're talking about laying off a bunch of public safety personnel.
Yeah.
That's been happening all over the state. I mean, think about it. It's $6 billion over 10 years. That has a huge impact on the local governments and on the state economy in general.
You were witness to a lot of these tax debates.
Oh, 20 years of
playing out from your position at the House Fiscal Agency, where you served for so many years. Looking back, I am really curious. What do you make of the credibility of the ongoing larger debate? Is this generally a credible debate between opposing philosophies, or does it contain, how much misinformation does it contain?
Well, it's philosophy, but it's also ideology, and ideology has risen to a point of almost religious conviction. People say, this is what I believe, so it must be true, regardless of what the data say, which really irritates someone like me. In fact, I'm not a real fan of either side. I'm not a member of either party. I never want to run for office, and I'm not a fan of either side. But the idea of having a rational political debate is almost an oxymoron.
Mitch Bean is the former director of the House Fiscal Agency. Today he's a founder and partner of the Great Lakes Economic Partners in Eaton Rapids, and we've been talking about the Drake Report. Mitch, many thanks. Appreciate it. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you very much for joining us. As Michigan lawmakers make their way to their offices today, they'll be offered some treats from a group that is sweet on gun sense. The organization Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America will rally at the Michigan Capitol today at 11:30 a.m. A year ago, the group lobbied for legislation requiring background checks for the purchase of firearms. Since it was introduced in the House, no further action has been taken. Linda Brundage is the leader and founder of the Mid-Michigan chapter of Moms Demand Action, and she joins us by phone now to discuss today's event. Linda Brundage, welcome.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here.
As we said, your organization lobbied for the introduction of a background check bill that was presented a year ago. Where does that bill currently stand?
It is currently in the House Judiciary Committee, which is chaired by Kevin Cotter. Our group has met with everyone on Judiciary, and nothing has happened, despite the fact that 90% of citizens want background checks on all gun purchases.
Tell us more about the legislators who are not on board with you on this. Tell us more about what they say when you discuss this with them.
Well, actually, discuss is not the word that I might use, Mark. They listen politely, and that's pretty much it. I don't know actually what goes on for them. But this morning, this noon actually, we intend to bring this issue to the attention both of the greater legislature and, of course, to the people of Michigan. It's kind of unfortunate that people sort of think that we're going away. And, of course, we are not. Moms don't go away.
Why do you support, what would expanded background checks do, Linda?
Well, currently there's a background check system in place in Michigan for the pistoling process. To purchase a pistol, you must go back, you must have a background check. This would extend that law to all gun sales, long guns, that sort of thing. So it's not rocket science. It's not something new. It's not something that gun owners are not used to doing. But really, do we want people with a mental health history, a severe adjudicated mental health history, a felony, that sort of thing? Do we want those people owning guns? Currently, if you had a gun and I had $1,000, we could meet in your work parking lot. I could wag on over and you could sell me the gun out of your trunk. That would be legal.
What do you want to accomplish at your rally today?
We want to shine a light on the lack of inaction of the legislators. There are several legislators who are with us. The bill had 18 co-sponsors, and when they walk by, we will applaud and thank them for their courage. And when people we know are opposed to us walk by, we will say, give us a vote. Michigan deserves a hearing on this vote, on this issue.
Your organization has recently created a coalition with local mayors called Every Town for Gun Safety. What are your aims with this effort?
Actually, Mark, that's a national coalition of mayors against illegal guns and Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America.
Okay.
Our point in developing a coalition with them was to give us a broader voice. Now our coalition is the largest gun sense organization in the country. So again, moms aren't going away.
Do you have a particular?
Today I have a letter that is signed by 16 member mayors from the state of Michigan to the majority and minority people in the Senate and the majority and the minority people in the House of Representatives in strong support of House Bill 4774. So that's the kind of work our coalition is going to do.
Linda Brundage is the leader and founder of the Mid-Michigan chapter of Moms Demand Action. She has a rally, her group has a rally scheduled for today at the Michigan Capitol at 11:30 a.m. Thanks for joining us, Linda.
Oh, thanks, Mark. I appreciate having the voice.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Ibuprofen is one of the most widely used over-the-counter pain medications in the United States. Many consumers know it under such brand names as Advil and Motrin. The labeling on these products claims it treats a variety of pains, from headaches to arthritis to the common cold. A growing body of research in the last few years suggests those labels should contain stronger warnings. Studies have shown links between ibuprofen and cardiovascular and gastrointestinal disorders, and some medical experts are themselves sounding the call. Here to talk with us about the possible risks associated with ibuprofen is Dr. Beth Alexander, the university physician here at Michigan State University. Dr. Alexander, welcome back.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit more about how ibuprofen works. How does it work? What's it designed to do?
Well, ibuprofen is one in a whole class of drugs, all of which have very similar side effects and have the same actions you just described. And they're called NSAIDs, and that stands for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Aspirin is also one, but it is not usually included in the discussion about this because it was here a long time before all those other ones. But we've known for quite a while that they all have similar side effects, a little bit different depending on the length of action, but they act by inhibiting an enzyme called a cyclooxygenase, and there's both there are about 20 of them that are marketed in this country and are available both over the counter in and also in higher dose prescription strength. Then there's a selective inhibitor of the cyclooxygenase, which is the group that Vioxx and Bextra, which were taken off the market,
right,
and Celebrex is the one that's available in this country. There are others in other countries.
And what have we learned more recently about the side effects of ibuprofen?
Well, the side effects of ibuprofen and the other drugs in this class, pretty much all of them, are in three categories. There are renal side effects, and they, for people who have high blood pressure, they can make that worse. They can be toxic to the kidneys. So for people who have renal disease, they can make that worse. And they have gastrointestinal side effects, mainly bleeding and ulcers. And so for people with that set of challenges, this class of drugs makes those symptoms, or can make those symptoms, worse. And then there are cardiac side effects. That's the other major category. Most of the cardiac side effects are by making the blood pressure worse, but there are separate cardiac side effects as well. So generally, the side effects are more common in people with certain diseases and are more common the older you get and are more common the higher the doses you are taking and the length of time you take them. So they're safer when taken intermittently, and safer at lower doses, and safer if you're 25 instead of 65.
And it suggests, I guess, apparently the research indicates there are times when it's advisable, it's more recommended that you take an NSAID than other times.
Yes, and there are people for whom it's safer than other people. And so I think we've become a little more aggressive in trying to warn people who are at higher risk of the side effects of these drugs about if they need to take them, how they should take them, and trying to give them alternatives if they really shouldn't be on them. The irony is the people who really need drugs that help joint pain and musculoskeletal pain are older people, and those are the very people for whom extended use over age 60 is not recommended.
Our guest on Current State, Dr. Beth Alexander, university physician here at Michigan State, and we are talking about recent research suggesting that greater caution ought to be used when ingesting NSAIDs, which include ibuprofen and various other NSAID again stands for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory
drug,
like Advil, Motrin. Advil and Motrin, Naproxen, are aggressively marketed. We've all seen TV commercials for the latest pill that lists a long string of potential side effects as a disclaimer. Not so, though, with drugs like Advil and Aleve. Why is that?
I don't know. They've managed to get by with it, is what I would say, because we've known about those side effects for a while. The ones that are over the counter, I think people assume that they're safer than perhaps they really are and can take them in large amounts. They just take more pills or take them for extended periods of time. And of the hospitalizations in this country, about 6 to 7% of all hospital admissions are from drug side effects, any kind of drug side effect. Mm-hmm. And of those admissions that are from drug side effects, about 12% of them are drug side effects of this class of drugs. So it's not uncommon when you think about serious side effects.
I am a longtime ingester of up to 800 milligrams of ibuprofen, mm-hmm. sometimes three times a day, mm-hmm. when I've been battling one painful malady or another, and there are a lot of people
like you,
like me, who have come to regard ibuprofen and other NSAIDs as more or less benign. It seems like
right.
There's some awareness raising that needs to
there
be
is.
Taking place here.
Actually, both among patients and among
physicians
yeah. and healthcare providers, because I think many still prescribe them for the older set without really thinking about whether it's wise.
And so is the front line, you can say there's a front line on both sides of this. The clinicians need to be maybe more aware of this, but obviously people are accustomed to taking
right.
Ibuprofen need to be.
And it doesn't mean don't ever take them, what I would say to you. Be aware of the risks. Take as low a dose as you can. And try not to take them sort of continuously for an extended period of time. Those things are protective. Take them with food. And talk to your healthcare provider if you should have any one of several conditions that would make the risks much higher. High blood pressure is one. Cardiovascular disease is another. Any kidney disease, gastrointestinal disease. And if you're on one of several other medicines that will interact adversely with this class of drugs. And I think those things, we're doing not a good job of educating the public about it.
Ibuprofen is generally quite effective as a pain reliever, though.
Yes.
Is it not?
Yes, it
yeah,
is. That's its appeal.
It works. Yeah. Some of these studies in the past 5 years have pointed to, we mentioned gastrointestinal damage. By taking ibuprofen before and possibly even during exercise, how common is this situation?
Well, it's pretty common. The people who exercise intensively and need it are generally, this is a stereotype, a bit younger. So you don't see a lot of 90-year-olds taking ibuprofen before they exercise every day because they don't exercise to that level, although there are some now that we say exercise is good for you. More and more people who are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s are exercising regularly, and they often will take an ibuprofen.
This is really hitting close to home. I have struggled with borderline osteoporosis for
right.
many years. I've combated that with three times a week visits to the weight room. The weight training has led to a reliance on ibuprofen.
Right.
And on occasion, that has meant taking 600 milligrams of ibuprofen immediately before I go into the weight room. So I am sitting here reviewing my relationship with NSAIDs.
With ibuprofen.
As we have this discussion.
Right.
Continuing.
Right. And the hard part is, there aren't perfect pain-relieving medicines that have no side effects. So you have to be educated about what...
Side effects. Specifically. Dr. Beth Alexander is the university physician here at Michigan State University. We've been talking about NSAIDs, which include ibuprofen. Many thanks, Dr.
You're
Alexander.
You're welcome. Keep exercising.
Okay. It is Wednesday, and it's time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, when we feature people and organizations working to make the greater Lansing community a better place. Today, we feature one woman's effort to turn her passion for addressing the horrors of human trafficking into action. Back in 2007, Sherry Montgomery first learned about the issues surrounding human trafficking. 7 years later, she's trying to start a new program in the Lansing area called the House of Promise to help girls and women in Michigan who have been victims of human trafficking. Sherry Montgomery joins us now to tell us more about her efforts. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
What exactly drew you to the issue of human trafficking?
Like you just said, back in 2007, we had someone that came to our church and spoke about how girls at about 5 years old were sold into sex slavery. And by the time they were 18, they were known as being used up and no good and then sold into regular slavery. And something just broke inside of me. And when I left that day, I have not been the same. And I thought maybe I was going to have to go over to overseas where I thought all this was happening at. But as my journey, I realized it's right here in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Michigan is in the top five in the United States for human trafficking.
Do we know why that is?
I think there's a lot of different things. We have the waterways that come into Michigan that people are shipped in and out. We have a huge trucking industry that comes in and out, that humans are trafficked in and out. But it doesn't, the sex trafficking trade, there is no certain race or amount of money you make. It hits everybody. Right now, sex trafficking is the second largest business in the world, selling women.
And you reached a point where you just felt you felt compelled to get involved and to do something.
Yes.
Do you have any experience or background in social work?
No. I own a glass shop here in town. I mean, this is not my background at all. This was not what I was going to do the second half of my life by any stretch of the imagination. But my journey has been, I've been in training, I guess is what you would say, since 2007, learning more and more about it. And we are at the point now that I formed a board 2 years ago. I'm a 501c3, which was a challenge all in itself. We've identified the home, and now we're just trying to get the funds to get the home bought and up and running.
Okay, so that's where you are in the process.
Yep.
Right now.
Yes.
What do you want the House of Promise to accomplish exactly? How would it work?
The House of Promise is going to be a 2-year program. You know, we have safe houses in Michigan, and we have things, but we don't have anything really that will restore these girls where they can actually go back out in the community and be who I believe God created them to be. So we will take these girls in. It will only be girls that want to get out of the life. It's a 2-year program. They will get their schooling. They will get all their health care needs. We are not taking any government funding, so it's all privately funded. They'll learn life skills. We're going to equip them for when they leave. There's very little chance, if any, that they would go back into that life.
Who will be doing all of this important work?
I'm the director. I'm the one with the vision. So, you know, it starts with me. But we will have counselors on staff. We'll have a teacher on staff. It's an expensive endeavor. Research has shown that it takes about 2 staff members to every girl because they are so damaged and need so much love. So I'm building my team right now. You know, we really have, you know, I'm really almost ready to go. I just need the most important thing, the house.
The house is just the location is really what's...
We've found the house. We know the price is just raising the money to get that now.
To purchase
yep.
the house.
Yep.
There got to be people listening who are curious about doing something similar for causes that they feel strongly about, but they aren't sure how to get started. What was the first thing you did?
the first thing I really did was start a prayer team. But then right after that, I started my board. Your best thing to do is start a board, because then they're going to help you get, you know, I made a business plan. I have a prospectus that I can hand to donors so they know what I'm going to do, basically. You have to have a plan. It's and then you just go one step at a time, filling out your licensing, your 501c3.
But have to have a board, right? I mean, that's a legal requirement.
Yes.
For a nonprofit. Yeah. Do you target your fundraising at a particular segment?
No, because my fundraising is twofold. I really believe there's people out in the community that just don't know what I'm trying to do, and I believe the money will come in for the house. Our fundraising, too, is to get people aware that this is happening right here, right now. The average age of a traffic girl here is 12 years old. We're not talking girls that we see walking the streets that we think that it's their choice. No little girl says, when I grow up, I want to be raped 15 to 30 times a night, or I want to be a prostitute. I think when people are hearing this message, there's people out there that say, I want to help. So that's my main, a big part of my fundraising is the awareness part.
How much more do you need to finalize the purchase of the house?
We need about $500,000.
And where is the location? Where is this house?
I can't tell you the location for safety of the girls,
okay,
but I can tell you it is in Lansing, and it will hold 10 girls immediately. It's got enough room for the schooling and everything right on the property. Plus, there's about 95 acres around it that down the road I'll be able to purchase, and my goal is to be able to rescue 100 girls at a time.
Apparently, you made the decision not to accept state funding
Yes.
for this project. Why not?
Because it's a Christian-based program. And so, I get dictated to more what I can do. But two, there's so many, the people that I've talked to, there's so many hoops you have to jump through for government. And there's, you know, a lot of times you spend as much money trying to get the government money than you do. And I believe our community is a generous community that has a big heart. And I believe this community can support something like this without going to the government.
You're listening to Current State's Neighbors in Action. Our guest today, Sherry Montgomery, the founder of the House of Promise, a program she hopes will be able to offer comprehensive services to victims of human trafficking here in Lansing. I understand you have one young woman you're already working with.
Yes.
Tell us about that process. Tell us about her.
Well, you know, we were doing our first fundraiser, Beauty for Ashes, in November, and I was actually in Atlanta visiting my mother, and this young lady called me on my cell phone, and she said, I want to be a part of your program, and I'm thinking she wanted to be a part of the fundraiser. Or maybe, I do get a lot of calls, people that want to volunteer, and I said, okay, so where do you see yourself in this? And she said, so-called uncle had raped me for about a year and a half, and I just about dropped the phone. I'm like, oh, you want to actually be a part of the program? And I said, are you someplace safe? And she said, yes, that the perpetrator, it was in jail. And I said, I need to call you back. I don't know what to do. I don't have the house yet. I do have one of our counselors already, and so she agreed to take her on, and we're working with her. She's in a safe place. But and since then, I've had Homeland Security call me twice. I've had DHS call me. There's a lot of people waiting for me to get this home opened, because young ladies are going back into the life, because when there's a raid, there's no place to put these girls.
So they've been contacting you because you are a potential
safe place.
Resource,
yes.
And safe place.
Yes.
What services are out there already for this? Or are those services that are out there overwhelmed by?
It's very muddy right now. You know, when you talk to one person, that's something, you know, they'll give you one number and someone will give you another number. But the bottom line is there's very few. There's under 200 beds across the whole United States for these girls. So if that tells you, there's just... and our laws, we have awesome lawmakers right now, Senator Emmons and Senator Hune, and some that are trying to make laws to protect these girls. But as far as just safe places for them, there may be a safe home that they can stay at for a short period of time, but there's nothing like in this area, like my home, that they won't leave until they're healed.
Mm. Now, are you at the point where you're ready for volunteers yet, or are you consulting with people who might be amongst your professional staff, or is that really waiting for the purchase of the home?
We're waiting for a lot of the volunteers. There are some things that I need now, you know, that have, you know, helped, like grant writing, that kind of thing. But even the grant writing, they're saying, you know, we want to give you money, but we want you to get the house first. So, you know, what I tell people is to email me, tell me what your interests are. We have a database that we're keeping all the people that want to volunteer. So when we get the house, we can contact them and get them rolling with that.
$500,000 is not an insignificant sum of money.
No, it's not.
Are you prepared for a long wait for that? Or do you have a timeline where you'd really like to be up and running here?
Or? You know, with the people know that they, you know, we want the house and they really want us to get it by the end of the year. One of the grants that I have, I have a year to get the house to receive that grant. So, yes, I would really I really need this by the end of the year.
Well, Sherry, we wish you luck. Sherry Montgomery is the founder of the House of Promise, which is a program she hopes will be able to offer comprehensive services to victims of human trafficking here in Lansing. Sherry, thanks for joining us
today.
Thank
you.
Good luck. We could always use more nominations, and Current State knows there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work, but we just don't know about them. Please help us out. Tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State, or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It seems that no matter where you go, grabbing a meal at a food truck is a growing phenomenon. At this point in the Lansing area, if you want to patronize a food truck, there's probably one running somewhere. You just need to figure out where they are from day to day. New to the food truck trend, though, could be the idea of a food truck court. One of them has sprung up in Lansing, and Current State Scott Pohl stopped by earlier this week. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. You know, when you think food court, you think of the dining area of a shopping mall with tables surrounded by vendors.
Of course.
A food truck court is a bit different. The trucks come to the same spot every day, and patrons have their choice from the operations that happen to be there that day. In a parking lot on Oakland Avenue between Cedar and Larch in Lansing, a food truck court might be bringing this next wave of on-the-go dining to town. I talked with property owner Gary Ganakis and one of the vendors, Donnie Apolsky, but let's kick things off with Frank Tignanelli of Detroit Frankie's Wood-Fired Brick Oven. This food truck court was his idea. We started by talking about the pizzas he makes in his mobile wood-fired oven.
Well, that's a homemade crust that I use, and those tomatoes are fresh-packed tomatoes, which means they go from the field to the can in less than 3 hours. I actually worked for that company for 10 years. I was a regional manager for them. And then, as you can see there, the pepperonis, it's a higher-end pepperoni. It's made with quality products as far as it's shoulder meat instead of fat trimmings. And the Italian sausage, it's rope Italian sausage that I hand slice myself, and there's no secret, I don't think, to making good pizzas. It's just use good ingredients.
How long has it been that you've been setting up here?
March 18th was my first day, and really the first day I thought people treated me pretty well and had a pretty decent day. Braved the weather quite a few times, and the snow and the wind and the rain and all that, but overall it's been a good experience so far.
Now, since your wood-fired pizza oven is mobile,
You are also available to cater, perhaps cook pizzas at a big party sort of a thing. People can come to you for that sort of service.
Right. I actually, from last year, I've got graduation parties booked, a wedding that I'm doing, and I've got some festivals that I do. So that's why I'm out here Monday through Friday, like my day job, and then the weekends I can keep open for events and parties and things.
Now we're on a busy stretch of Oakland Avenue here in Lansing. You're between Cedar and Larch. So there's all sorts of auto traffic through here. Are people seeing your operation and just whipping in to give it a try? Is that where some of your traffic is coming from?
Well, I think the statistics are there's like 38,000 cars a day go by here. And I think that probably 30% of them, their eyes come right to the oven as they drive by. So for sure, a lot of them pull in and they want to at least come in and see what I'm doing, check it out. And most of them all come back. And one of the reasons I picked this corner is just mainly the traffic's very good.
Now you're hoping that other mobile food operations will join you at this location, right?
We are, for sure. We've got one right now, Michael O's, and they've been with us a week now, and we're talking to a few other ones. So yeah, we hope to have, just like you'd find in Seattle or San Francisco or Portland or Austin, Texas, you know, we want Lansing to have a food court here.
Are you expecting, if that were to work out to your dreams, so to speak, that there would be a variety of operations here, not just on a given day, but from day to day, that some might take their trailer somewhere else some days of the week, that when you come by here, you may not know exactly which operations are here?
I kind of like that idea of a revolving vendors, kind of, where you know, somebody might come in for 2 or 3 days that week and maybe, you know, once a month or something, but you're not always going to find the same thing here.
You've got tons of pizza making experience, I understand, 40 years plus.
Yeah, I do. My grandma and grandpa, my grandpa come over from Italy and they made pizzas back in the early 60s. My mom and dad owned a couple pizzerias and my dad worked for Lombardi Food Service, and my whole life I've never done anything else but make pizzas. For me, it's been a dream to get the wood-fired oven and just make pizzas one at a time. What I try to do is make every pizza like I'm making it for my mom, and so far everybody's been pretty happy with the product.
I'm Donald Opolsky, owner of Michael O's Food Truck.
So you are here in this location just steps away from Frankie's pizza oven. What drew you to join him in operating your business here?
The location is great. I recently moved back from Tucson, Arizona, where food trucks are the thing. They're everywhere, and I was hoping to bring a little of that to the Lansing area, having grown up here. And this seems like a good spot to bring everyone together.
Did you run a food truck in Tucson?
No, I was general manager of a restaurant there and had looked at opening a food truck, and this seemed like a better area to try it out.
Is this brand new then, or have you been in operation elsewhere before coming here?
This is brand new. Right now is it set up. It was in operation a few years ago with my mom and one of her business partners at fairs and festivals and such, doing different foods, so this is brand new to us now.
How are things going here?
It's a little slow to start, but I expected that, and it's picking up, so I think it's good.
Envisioning a day when there will be multiple food truck type operations in this spot, you're in on the ground floor.
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity to start out and really help create a culture in the city of Lansing that focuses on local vendors that are bringing something to the table that's restaurant quality food at an affordable price.
So what's on my table when I come here?
We serve mostly sandwiches. I smoke all of my meats, pork, chicken, and turkey. I make all of my sauces from scratch, barbecue and mayonnaise, everything. Then we have sides, mac and cheese, and pasta salad. So a nice variety of items, but not too many as we're a small kitchen.
Here's a question for you. There are a couple of local restaurants that started out with food trucks, and now they also have a brick and mortar restaurant. Is that something that you're hoping to do at some point?
Yeah, I think long-term goal for us is to open a location in Old Town, possibly, or we're from East Lansing, so maybe in East Lansing as well. But certainly right now our focus is the food truck. I like the idea of being able to go to where the customers are as opposed to the customers needing to come to us all the time.
Gary Ganakis owns the property where Detroit Frankie's is located. So what does this bring to your property to have this kind of operation parked here?
I hope that it brings fun, that we have a property here that has access on three major thoroughfares, and we have a tremendous amount of cars go by. So to have Frank out here with a wood-burning stove is kind of cool. And people come in, and they're pretty happy, and the pizza is really, really good. So it's kind of a fun venture for us. This was an Arby's restaurant for over 25 years. And when they wanted us to rebuild the building and parking lot and so forth, we decided that we just didn't have the resources to do that. So we've kind of tried some other businesses here, and we haven't really quite decided what's going to go here next. I think it's more of a commercial venture because the property's so large and has access to three major arteries, so we're just kind of waiting to see. And in the meantime, if we can have a couple, we're going to try an outdoor food court and just have fun with it for the summer months.
So was Frank first?
Frank was first. He came to us and wanted to do this, and such a great guy, and that's part of the lure of what he does. He not only is his product really good, but he's such an entrepreneur. He's a nice fella. He's got a background in restaurant industry. So it was kind of an easy sell, and then he's located a couple other food vendors, and we're looking for people that have different variations of food to get maybe four or five of them in here in this area and kind of have a fun summer.
Frank, I got to try it. Luckily, I'm into meat lovers type pizza, so this, will be good.
That's usually what the guys, if they're in a hurry at lunchtime, and the most popular are pepperoni and the meat lovers, so I'll make sure I always have those out there.
All right, here we go. That's delicious.
Well, thank you. A lot of experience goes into it.
Frank Tignanelli of Detroit Frankie's Wood-Fired Brick Oven, currently located on Oakland Avenue between Larch and Cedar in Lansing. Thank you for spending some time with me, and good luck.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl, and I'm going to finish my pizza right now.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Thursday here on Current State, we'll learn about a new study that explores the connection between spirituality and the outdoors. Also, Current State contributor Scott Southard reviews Matt Bell's latest book. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.